Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, as the rhetoric heats up over regime change in Iran, what comes to mind with this situation? The U.S. leads an invasion in a far-off country. The president believes American troops will be welcomed as liberators, but they get quickly bogged down in a fierce resistance with thousands of casualties ensuing. As the war goes on, there are charges of atrocities, and military commanders are put on the defensive about violating prisoner treatment laws. Well, if you think I'm talking about the current war in Iraq, think again. The president in this case was William McKinley, and the war was in the Philippines in 1898. And it's a parallel my next guest wants to draw. He says the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq did not mark a shift in U.S. foreign policy, but rather was part of a pattern of American overthrows going as far back as Hawaii in 1893. And as the rhetoric heats up over regime change in Iran, he says Americans would do well to remember the last time the U.S. intervened there. Former New York Times foreign correspondent Stephen Kinzer is the author of Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, published by Times Books. And he joins me now. Stephen, thanks for coming in.
Great to be with you, Brian.
You write that the biggest problem with U.S. government overthrows is how quickly we forget. And I just want to list the countries that you cover. Hawaii, Cuba, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Nicaragua, Honduras, Iran, Guatemala, South Vietnam, Chile, Grenada, Panama, Afghanistan, and of course, Iraq. Something about these ring a bell with you.
What I'm trying to do is something I think it's a little bit new. A number of these interventions have been studied individually. And in fact, I've written books about our coup in Iran and our coup in Guatemala. But I don't think anybody has tried to look at them all together. So what I'm doing in this book is to look at the 14 times the United States overthrew a foreign government and look at them not as a series of isolated incidents, but as a continuum that stretches out over more than 100 years. And for each of these 14 cases, I'm asking three questions. First of all, what happened? How did we overthrow the government of this particular country? Second, why did we do it? And third, from the perspective of today, from the perspective of history, what has been the long-term effect of our interventions? So by asking these questions about 14 different coups and revolutions and covert actions, 14 times when the U.S. overthrew a foreign government, I'm able to tease out some patterns that might not be clear if you study these episodes as unrelated.
So let's start to do that. What fundamentally ties them together?
There's one important pattern that emerges about the question of why we do it. The first thing that these target or victim countries do that attracts the attention of the U.S. government is that the leader of the country is usually some kind of a nationalist whose nationalist economic policies lead him into conflict with some foreign, usually an American, corporation. In 1909, President Zelaya of Nicaragua had not insisted on borrowing money from European banks instead of American banks, and if he had not bothered the Emery Lumber Company based in Boston or the La Luz Mining Company based in Pittsburgh, we never would have overthrown him, and perhaps Nicaragua would be a much more stable country today. The same thing is true of copper in Chile or oil in Iran or bananas in Guatemala. But that's just the beginning of the interventions. The U.S. and presidents of the United States do not carry out overthrows of foreign governments strictly to defend the interests of American corporations. Once the heads of these corporations come to the White House to complain that a government in a certain country is not allowing them to operate freely, the rationale morphs a little bit. It gets transformed from an economic one into what is called a political or a geostrategic one. The U.S. government assumes or convinces itself that any government that would bother or harass or restrict or nationalize an American company must be anti-American, repressive, brutal, anti-democratic, and probably the tool of some foreign world power that is urging, that is trying to undermine American influence all over the world. So that's the transformation that happens from the business side to the political side. And then there's one more transformation that comes when the leaders of the United States have to sell or explain the reasons for the intervention to the American people. Then the motivation transforms a second time from economic and political to liberation. The movements that the U.S. launches to overthrow foreign governments are generally explained as movements to liberate brutally oppressed foreign nations. This is actually a very good argument that in the United States. It plays very well because it ties into two aspects that I think are very deep in the American soul. First of all, we really are very compassionate people. We don't like the idea that people are suffering in other countries. We want to help. And secondly, we're very naive about the outside world and about history of the world. So we assume that it's possible by direct intervention to do this.
We'll go back to some of these specific examples in a minute, beginning with Hawaii. But there is the philosophy of American exceptionalism, which William Crystal, among others, would argue very forcefully in the case of Iraq, is something that makes our interest consistent with the interest of most of the rest of the world. That yes, it may be in our economic interest to go into Iraq, it may be in our national security interest to go into Iraq, but it's also legitimately in the interest of the people of Iraq to be liberated from Saddam Hussein, and generally of the people of the world to have the United States as the kind of international overseer, formally or informally. I mean, Crystal and his ilk, I think, genuinely believe that rather than think that they're just doing it on behalf of their cronies in the corporate suites or something like that.
Well, that's why it works so well. You're right that there is a view in certain circles, including powerful circles in Washington today, that what's good for the United States is actually good for everybody, and that American influence in the world is all for the good. It's positive. What I'm trying to say in my book is, first of all, who decides this? It's the United States that decides that the United States is good for everybody. We don't ask anyone else. We don't even ask our own allies. We are not even able to get NATO behind interventions like the kinds we carry out in places like Iraq. But I think you're very right in saying that an important motivation for American intervention abroad is the sense that we Americans have been blessed with such gifts. We have a prosperous country, a free country, and because of these blessings, we have not only the right, but perhaps even the providential duty to go abroad and try to share what we have with other people.
The Declaration of Independence, the Constitution.
Those, of course, were only intended to apply within the United States. But again, the U.S. feels that it has found the magic formula, the way for everyone in the world to be happy. And we tend to believe that people in every place in the world would really like to live like Americans, to have American-style government, American-style economy, and be friendly to the United States. And the only thing that's preventing them is that there's a tiny clique of gangsters at the top of their regime. And if we could only get rid of those tiny cliques, everybody in the world would love us.
Stephen Kinzer, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. And we can take phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Let's go over some of these examples, and let's start with Hawaii. Obviously, a state now, but you list it as the very first example, the first government overthrow brought about by the U.S. And while anti-war protesters say invasions are all about oil, nowadays you say that one was about sugar.
Many Americans, I think even today, don't realize that Hawaii was once an independent country. It was under a monarchy. In the early 19th century, several hundred American missionaries from New England landed there to carry out what they would have described as the raising up of the heathen savages and teaching of Christian civilization. It wasn't long before some of these missionaries and their sons realized there was a lot of money to be made in Hawaii. Pretty soon, by expropriating large amounts of land, they built big sugar plantations and made big fortunes by exporting their sugar into the U.S. In the early 1890s, the U.S. passed a tariff that made it impossible for foreign sugar growers to send their sugar into the U.S. That was ruinous for the Hawaiian planters. So they asked themselves, what can we do to continue selling our sugar in the U.S.? And they came up with the answer, we'll just bring Hawaii into the U.S. So with the cooperation of the U.S. ambassador, authorized by the President of the United States and the Secretary of the Navy, a small group of just a couple of dozen white planters in Hawaii pronounced the overthrow of the monarchy and declared that they were the new government. Before the Queen could respond, the U.S. ambassador called ashore 250 U.S. Marines who were conveniently waiting in a U.S. military vessel, and they guarded the new government. They guarded the new white planter elite in their offices, and that made it impossible for the Queen to respond. It was that simple.
Funny enough, as I understand that history, that was the ambassador acting on his own without sanction from the government in Washington.
Actually, the leader of the white planters in Hawaii had gone to Washington. He'd met with the Secretary of the Navy. He'd presented his case to President Benjamin Harrison. So this was one that, although it was taken place in an era before instant communications, did have the rubber stamp of the White House.
Hawaii didn't actually become a U.S. protectorate until 5 years later. And at that point, the U.S. had also taken control of Cuba and Puerto Rico from the Spanish in the Spanish-American War. What about the driving force behind that? A lot of historians, I think, talk about that as almost a uniquely imperialistic moment in American history. Obviously, you don't see it that way.
It was an imperialist moment. I wouldn't go so far as to say it was unique. The Cuba situation is a perfect example of how these operations have terrible long-term after effects in ways that nobody could have imagined. In 1898, the U.S. decided to send troops to Cuba to help Cuban patriots overthrow Spanish colonial rule. At first, the patriots were not so sure they wanted thousands of American soldiers on their soil, but when the U.S. passed a law, the Teller Amendment, promising that immediately after the victory over Spain, all American troops would be withdrawn, then the Cubans agreed, okay, fine, send your soldiers. The American troops went there, including Teddy Roosevelt with a uniform he had personally designed at Brooks Brothers. In a very short time, Spanish colonial rule was overthrown, but then the Americans changed their mind. They decided they didn't want an independent Cuba. The patriots were interested in cutting up the American-owned sugar plantations and dividing up the land among ordinary Cubans. They wanted to restrict the amount of American manufactured goods that could be sold in Cuba so Cuban manufacturing could grow. As a result, the U.S. put Cuba under a military governor and then later ruled it through a series of pliable dictators. Flash forward to 1959. Fidel Castro took over, and in his very first speech as leader of the Cuban Revolution, he said, "I promise you that this time it will not be like 1898 again when the Americans came in and made themselves masters of our country." So we would not have had to face the whole phenomenon of Castro communism if we had kept our word to the Cubans 60 years earlier.
We have to take a break in a minute. When we come back, we'll take some phone calls. We'll talk about Iran the first time, among other examples. But there are two countries conspicuously missing from your list in this book, Japan and Germany after World War II, who some might argue, you know, are the archetypal or maybe the only positive examples of U.S. intervention and regime change, but overwhelmingly positive. Why didn't you include those?
I say in my introduction that there are a number of categories of interventions that I don't cover, and one is where the U.S. participated in a big coalition with other countries to change whole ruling orders, which it did during World War II. Actually, when you read in the history of American intervention and overthrows of foreign governments, you see that World War II is really an exception because that was a rare moment when the U.S. actually fought tyranny to impose democracy. As I think my book shows, usually it was the other way around.
Stephen Kinzer is the author of the book Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. We'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with former New York Times foreign correspondent Stephen Kinzer, now the author of Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. We'll go to your calls in just a couple of minutes. We talked about World War II a little bit just before the break, and you write in this book that a big shift in this history happened after World War II when foreign intervention went covert. And you actually wrote an entire book a few years ago about one of those events, Iran. That book, for those of you who might know it, was all the Shah's men. So remind us very briefly what happened in 1953 with the CIA and then Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh.
It's hard to imagine today that you could even use the word Iran and the word democracy in the same sentence. But in fact, Iran was a thriving, growing, consolidating democracy in the late 40s and early 50s. It produced a visionary nationalist leader, Prime Minister Mossadegh. But being a nationalist, he went ahead and nationalized the Iranian oil industry, which had been monopolized by a big foreign company. That set in motion a chain of events that led to his overthrow in the summer of 1953. What was the result of that overthrow? We put the Shah back in power. He ruled with increasing repression for 25 years. His repression produced the explosion of the late 1970s, what we call the Islamic Revolution. That revolution brought to power a clique of fanatically anti-American clerics who began their rule by sanctioning the seizure of American diplomats and have spent the last quarter century intensely and sometimes quite violently fighting American and Western interests all over the world. We are now facing another big world crisis with Iran. None of that would have happened if we had not intervened there in 1953. We might have had a thriving democracy in the heart of the Muslim Middle East all these last 50 years. And I can hardly wrap my mind around what the Middle East might look like today if we had been patient and just allowed Iranian politics to take their normal course.
Another big theme of your book, which is that these interventions in so many cases, even though they're done for the interest of the United States or some Americans, wind up backfiring.
You asked earlier about what are the patterns that I see after looking at all these different interventions in my new book. And one of them has to do with what happens afterwards. They all have terrible unintended consequences. It's when you overthrow a government, it's a little bit like releasing a wheel at the top of a hill. You never know where it's going to bounce or where it's going to land. Now, the crucial moment in all these interventions, as I found from studying them, comes right after we carry out the overthrow. Then we have to decide, who are we going to put in power as the new leader? We want a guy who fulfills two qualifications. Number one, he should be popular. And number two, he should do what we want. We quickly find out you can't have both, because a person who's popular will put the interests of his own country first ahead of those of the U.S. That's why we choose someone who will do what we want. He needs to rule with increasing repression. That produces upheaval and ultimately the emergence of regimes far worse and far more anti-American than the ones we originally intervened to overthrow.
Let's see. Does that run through all these 14? I'm going to read the list again for people just tuning in. The places you cover in this book: Hawaii, Cuba, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Nicaragua, Honduras, Iran, Guatemala, South Vietnam, Chile, Grenada, Panama, Afghanistan, Iraq. Didn't happen in all those cases.
Actually, there are two cases on the list that you read that I think are very interesting exceptions. One is Hawaii, and the other is Puerto Rico. Now, there are people there who still resent those interventions, but looking around the neighborhood of where those countries or regions are now, many people would have to say they're probably better off than most of their neighbors. Why is that? It's because the United States did not tyrannize those places through local dictators, but actually took full responsibility for their development and over a period of years provided them with a lot of the benefits of life as Americans. That's not possible in most other parts of the world. And that's what makes those two a little bit different.
Nicaragua, a little better off today than it was under the Sandinistas?
Perhaps better than the Sandinistas, but take it back to the beginning. In the first decade of the 20th century, Nicaragua was under the rule of a great visionary leader named Zelaya, a crusading reformer who had been educated in Europe. He actually came home with a Belgian wife. He built ports and schools and hospitals and government buildings and railroads, but he also was a nationalist, and he came into conflict with American companies. That was used as the excuse to overthrow his regime.
And, of course, that was the Nicaraguan incident that you're referring to a century ago rather than the one during the 1980s.
Exactly. It was this overthrow in 1909 that cast Nicaragua into this pit of violence, conflict, and terrible poverty from which it has still not emerged. Nicaragua did not have to be like this. Nicaragua could easily have emerged like its neighbor, Costa Rica. as a prosperous democracy. It didn't happen because the United States intervened there once in 1909 and then had to continue intervening, sending Marines and intervening in many different ways over a period of a century in order to maintain its influence there.
Keith in Seaford, you're on WNYC. Hello, Keith.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Okay.
I've noticed that if you look at through the Cold War, the nations that we fought the hardest and lost the most lives trying to defeat communism are basically the few nations that are left that are communist. Vietnam, Korea, Cuba, and I guess to a lesser extent China. We didn't really too often militarily attack China.
We never did actually invade Poland or Czechoslovakia or Romania or East Germany, and they wound up falling peacefully. Is there a cause and effect there?
I think there is a lesson that when you allow the political processes of a country to develop normally and you're patient, a lot of times we'll get the result that we and the people of those countries want. One of the problems with the United States being perhaps such a young country is that we want instant results. When we see a regime we don't like, we want that regime killed. We want it overthrown. We don't want to take the time that it takes to help build up a middle class, to trade, to engage. Because of our desire for a quick fix, we go in and overthrow regimes and later bring terrible consequences, not just onto the target countries, but also onto the United States.
Stephen Kinzer, my guest on WNYC, author of Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. James in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, James.
Hi. I can't disagree more with just about everything that your guest is saying. For one thing, it is absolutely true. I mean, he's left out some other glaring examples of positive results of United States intervention. Taiwan and South Korea are the two most prominent. I mean, surely the average Chinese person would have chosen to live under a society like Taiwan rather than Red China for the last 50 years.
When did the United States intervene in Taiwan?
What? No, the United States intervened in China by supporting the nationalists and the anti-communists, as it has done throughout the Third World for the last 50 years, because communism was an ideology on the march, was an aggressive ideology. It was not we tried containment, and to some extent that was certainly useful, but the fact is the Soviet Union was trying to export its ideology, and wherever it succeeded, by the way, it made life miserable. Africa today is the only part of the world, except for a few parts of Latin America, that is not progressing economically, and those are the areas where the Soviet ideology won. And that is a consequence of their winning, just as now in the Soviet former republics itself, they're economically backward and not making much economic progress. You've oversimplified by painting America as the demon of the 20th century. The truth is we've made some mistakes, and there was some downside to American interventionism. But on the whole, American interventionism allowed for life to go forward for most of the people of the world. Western Europe is another prime example. Western Europe was democratic, and the governments that emerged there usually acted in the interest of their own people, and we did not necessarily see that as counter to our interests, as you've portrayed, that whenever a country acts in its own interest, that is necessarily against American interests. That's simply false. America was totally satisfied by the outcome of World War II and the emergence of democracy in Western Europe and in Japan and eventually in South Korea and in Taiwan. I mean, all of these places are examples of American triumphalism. The most important point is, though, intervention is here to stay. Intervention is a byproduct of the increasing globalization, of the increasing interconnectedness of the world. The waves of migration of peoples from poor countries, the overpopulation in poor countries that force people to migrate to rich countries, make it necessarily true. 9/11 is another example.
Let me jump in there, James, before we get off on 9/11. You put a lot of interesting stuff on the table. But Stephen Kinzer, what of that do you want to respond to?
The United States led the fight to defeat Hitlerism. But after World War II, the United States began supporting a lot of little Hitlers throughout Latin America and the developing world. I think it's certainly true that the Soviet influence in the world was quite pernicious. On the other hand, why is it that so much of the world today is very angry and upset at the United States? We have a short historical memory. We don't remember what we did to Iran, but Iranians remember it. We don't remember what we did to Guatemala, but Guatemalans remember it. There have been all sorts of different forms of American intervention in the world. Some forms of it have been positive. But you're quite right to say that in the future, intervention is going to continue to happen, particularly given the imbalance between the United States and the rest of the world. It's unavoidable that the U.S. is going to intervene in other parts of the world. What I'm trying to do in my book is point out the ways that intervention can go wrong. I hope that in the future, when we do intervene, and certainly those cases are going to emerge as we look at Darfur, for example, in Africa, these are cases that are actually crying out for intervention. So what I'd like to see by studying the failures of past interventions is an answer to the question of how we can shape future interventions so that they have not only military power, but also legitimacy.
James, thank you for your call. Are there positive models of U.S. intervention other than Japan and Germany?
There aren't many.
He mentioned South Korea as another example, even though North Korea is still under its repressive regime.
South Korea and Taiwan are countries that were very harsh tyrannies for decades after they emerged as non-communist countries. And the United States engaged with them and slowly brought them out of their isolation to create thriving democracies. This is what I would like to see the United States do in a number of other countries. Trade with them, engage with them, build up their middle classes, because middle classes ultimately will demand political as well as economic freedoms. But those are projects that take a long time. And when we're patient in the world, we usually can achieve a positive result for countries. We often are too impatient. And that's one of the lessons I'm trying to draw in my book.
Jim in Union City, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jim.
Yeah, hi. The one exception, I would say, in East Asia also was the Philippines, which was under protectorate status, and apparently such a success. I remember in the Pentagon Papers, it was that Ho Chi Minh wrote Truman 9 letters asking for that status instead of reverting back to France after World War II, that we make, well, he requested the same status for Vietnam that we had successfully demonstrated in the Philippines, not having a heavy-handed approach.
You're right that Ho Chi Minh did appeal to the United States for help after the departure of the French after World War II, and it was really a tragedy for the United States that most of those letters seem to have gotten lost in the mail. The U.S. intervened very harshly in the Philippines in the early part of the 20th century. We had no idea that we were going to wind up being the colonial power against which a liberation movement would be fighting. But thousands of American soldiers were killed repressing the Philippine independence movement, and tens of thousands of Filipinos were killed. We have long since forgotten that this intervention ever happened. The Filipinos have not forgotten it, and their country ranks now, along with Iraq, as one of the most unstable in all of Asia.
In fact, I think that's one of the central messages of your book, how Americans either forget or just never learn the histories in the ways that they actually stick in these countries. For example, with 20,000 civilians and 16,000 guerrilla fighters killed in the Philippines, which a lot of Filipinos today could tell you about, even though it was a century ago.
One of the great lines I came across while researching the background of American intervention abroad was precisely from President Harry Truman. He said, "The only thing new in this world is the history you didn't know." I take that as a kind of a motto for the kind of books that I like to write.
You conclude with several what-if situations and the consequences that didn't come about. Like, what if the U.S. hadn't blocked elections in Cuba in the 50s and Castro opted for democratic means of change or was forced to? What if the U.S. hadn't interfered with Iran and a secular democracy emerged? What if the U.S. allowed elections in Vietnam in 1956 and how it might have avoided 2 million casualties there? And what if Americans had this history on their mind when the U.S. was considering invading Iraq? I mean, that's a lot of hindsight. Is it all fair? Is it all fair to assume that things would have turned out as well as that question frames it in each of those cases?
I guess we'll never know. But I think one of the lessons that we do draw from all these stories is that intervention produces results that undermine American security. They not only cast whole regions of the world into instability and anti-Americanism, but they lead us to lose what is actually now, in the current conflict in which we're involved, our most vital weapon. In our current conflict in the world, having the biggest army or the most weapons is not decisive. Otherwise, we would have already won by now. The real weapon in this war is information. We need to know who's out there. What are they doing? What are they saying? What are they planning? When are they going to strike? But who gives us that information? Ordinary people, intelligence agencies, governments. They only give it if they want to give it, if they respect and admire the person or government to whom they're giving the information. Do you think, for example, that if the villagers along the Afghan-Pakistani border really respected and admired the United States, Osama bin Laden would not have been captured long ago?
In fact, you write that the U.S. is now suffering what you call the danger of success. What does that mean exactly?
Sometimes we look at places like Iraq without thinking about all the dangers that might happen if we fail there. That's understandable, although probably not excusable. But sometimes we don't ask, what happens if we succeed? If we succeed in rebuilding a truly democratic and nationalist Iraq, that country is not necessarily going to be friendly to us. We have gotten ourselves now into a dangerous situation in much of the world where if true democracy emerges, it's also going to be accompanied by anti-Americanism. This is not something we had planned for.
There is an adage that says democracies don't attack each other militarily. So if it's a democracy, maybe it ultimately is safer for the United States, for Americans abroad, and for everybody else.
That adage is contradicted by a number of the chapters in my book. Guatemala was a thriving democracy and had been for 10 years by the time we overthrew its government in 1954. We imposed a very brutal and bloody tyranny in Guatemala that produced an uprising that led to 30 years of civil war, in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed. If that had been perpetrated by some other country in some other part of the world, we would probably be denouncing it as genocide. Iran was a democracy. Other countries in the world where we've intervened, like Chile, also, although not pro-American, were democratic. We replaced them with pro-American tyrannies.
We have about a minute left, under a minute. You wrote a whole book previously about Iran and the U.S. involvement in the overthrow of Mossadegh way back when. How would you start to deal with the Iranian crisis right now?
Iran is really the only country in the world now with which the United States refuses to negotiate. I think this is largely a hangover of the Islamic Revolution. We feel that the Islamic revolutionaries have hit us several times with the hostage crisis and a number of other episodes, and we want to get back at them before we negotiate with them. I think what we need to do now is get rid of this psychological barrier and try to sit down with Iranians to discuss not just the nuclear issue, but the whole range of issues that separates us. And I think then we're going to find that we have strategic interests in common with Iran. That country does not have to be our enemy.
Stephen Kinzer has written Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq. It's published by Times Books. You're doing a reading at the Barnes & Noble Broadway in 82nd, 7 o'clock tonight.
I'll be there.